Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Regina's mom was at her wits' end. Every day she packed her 10-year-old daughter's lunch for school, and every day Regina brought most of it back home. "Is there something special you'd like me to pack for you?" she asked for the umpteenth time. Regina shook her head. "Nah, it's just hard to eat much at school." "Don't they give you enough time for lunch?"
"Yeah."
"Well, what is the matter?" her mom persisted.
"It's just that I don't have anywhere to sit," Regina explained.
"There aren't enough seats?" Her mom was incredulous, thinking of the Mammoth School cafeteria.
"Oh, there are lots of seats, but groups of girls are sitting together and I can't sit where there are groups."
"Couldn't you find your friends, Alice and Chris, and sit with them?" Regina just looked away.
"I can't just go over and sit with them like that," she mumbled.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about shyness in children, and how can we help? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, we have two psychologists who are studying these kinds of problems to help us understand shyness. Dr. Samuel Turner is professor of psychology and director of clinical training at the University of Maryland, as well as co-director of the Maryland Center for Anxiety Disorders. His focus is on anxiety disorders and behavior. With Dr. Deborah Beidel, he is researching skills to help children with severe social phobias. He has one grown son. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Turner.
Thank you.
Dr. Deborah Beidel is also a professor of psychology at the University of Maryland and co-director of the Maryland Center for Anxiety Disorders, a clinical research center for the study of anxiety in adults and children. Her interests focus on child and adult anxiety disorders and their treatment. We're glad to have you with us, Dr. Beidel.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Dr. Turner, there's been some publicity for a theory that shyness has a chemical basis and so is a basic part of a child's personality scientifically. What do you think?
Well, I think that we really don't know the answer to that, but we are fairly certain that there are biological factors that are important in the development of temperament in all of us. So in general, I would respond to that by saying, yes, we think there probably are, but we have no knowledge at this particular point in time of any type of specific chemical imbalance, as the term is frequently used, that we can say is absolutely responsible for this condition.
Now, we have heard, though, that sometimes this idea of shyness runs in families, that this sort of tendency. So would that give credence to the idea that there's some genetic basis?
I think it would. And indeed, there might very well be some genetic component to this. We would not argue against that at all. I think because we know that this particular condition, as well as other anxiety disorders, and indeed many other emotional disorders, certainly run in families.
But we also know that there are other influences that might account for anxiety disorders running in families that may not necessarily be biological, and that is learning, for example. There's a condition or a learning experience called modeling, where very simply, we show people what to do when we want to teach them how to do something. So just like we show children how to ride a bike, it's very possible that parents may model fears that they have, and children may acquire those fears by observation of parents or other relatives. So I think when we say that things run in families, we have to think about both aspects, that there may be some biological predisposition, but there are probably also some powerful environmental forces that also play into the development of the disorder.
How can we tell, Dr. Beidel, if we have a shy child or if there are other issues influencing our child's behavior? The idea is, I guess, when is a stomachache just a stomachache?
Well, that's always a little difficult to work through. And I think certainly one of the things we know is that children, especially young children, often express their fears through physical complaints, such as stomach aches or headaches. So one thing that parents might want to look at is when these sort of physical symptoms might occur. For example, if a child only gets stomach aches or headaches when they have to engage in a social activity or go to school, for example. So they always have a stomach ache Sunday night or Monday morning, and they never have a stomach ache on the weekend. That might suggest that there's a reason for the stomach ache other than having eaten too much pizza, for example. The other thing is if you see the child sort of shying away, for example, from other people, there is a range of sociability. Not all children are as outgoing and gregarious as others might be. And so we want to look at whether or not the children fall somewhere within that normal range. So shy children are less likely to have friends, for example, might be less likely to want to go and do things like go to a party. But I think that, again, we have to look at what might be considered normal, and there's not any one thing that's normal. There's a variety of ways that people can interact with other people. And shyness is usually along the end of perhaps being a little more reticent, but not necessarily just being the most reticent child in the group.
Dr. Turner, how can we know if shyness is a problem that we should look into further for our child?
Very frequently, parents will come to us and say, you know, my child simply will not do the things that other children do. They don't want to go to parties. They don't want to go out and play. They don't play with the other kids at school. The teacher is saying, I can't get them to socialize with the other children. And then on occasion, though, even with young children, we will hear them say, I would wish I could go and play with the other kids, or I wish I had a friend, but I can't do that. I don't feel comfortable when I attempt to do this. What's wrong with me?
So that is a time when you want to get that child
that
some help.
Is a time when you want to think about getting help. And we do receive referrals from parents, but also from teachers, and sometimes from both.
So it means parents should be sure to be in touch with the teachers if they have any concerns about the child's behavior.
Well, absolutely. And as always, I think parents need to maintain close contact with the schools, with the teachers who are teaching their children. No matter how busy they are, it seems to me that they should do that. And even if they're not around that much, that's a good way of learning things about what their children are doing in school, but also what they're doing with other children, how they're functioning, how they're developing.
I think sometimes you find some children who are very quiet among the children in the neighborhood and at home, but blossom at school. For some reason, they open up more in a classroom.
And sometimes the settings will dictate. They'll be much more sociable in some settings than others. I think for those children and adults who are having significant difficulties, we tend to see consistency. That is to say, they're having difficulty no matter what the setting happens to be.
And sometimes it requires increasing awareness, too, on the parts of parents and teachers, because kids won't always be able to just go up and talk to adults about this. Remember one little boy that I was talking to about doing things in front of a group, and he said, every time we have to be in a play, I beg to be on the stage crew, because that way I don't have to go out in front of the audience. So, and another little boy who was talking about a similar situation said, the only time I could ever be in a play was when I wore a mask, because then nobody could see how bad I blush. And so kids are aware of these things, but it's not always something that they're going to come forward and talk about with people. But I think if parents or sensitive teachers see those kind of behaviors, they can pay attention to it. One of the problems in schools is that sometimes the really quiet children don't get much attention because the parents and the teachers are really more concerned about the children who are acting out. So the children who are sitting in their seats and being quiet and not making trouble are often overlooked when sometimes they have the same or different kinds of problems, but still in need of some attention.
Yeah, I think most of these children do not cause difficulties. There are exceptions. When the conditions are really severe, at times there will be behavior problems. But for the most part, these children are model students. They're very quiet. They do their work. And it's easy to overlook them and forget they're there.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of shyness in children.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. Today we are talking with Dr. Samuel Turner and Dr. Deborah Beidle about shyness. Dr. Beidle, how do we help a shy child behave more assertively? Assume for a minute that this is not a child who needs treatment, but this is a child who maybe would be happier if he or she could take part in things a little further.
Well, I think for children who may be shy, or sometimes we call them slow to warm up, so that they're the kind of children who initially may be very reticent, but then with some attention and in the situation for a period of time will feel more comfortable. I think for those type of children, one thing that parents might be able to do is really just make sure that the children are involved in a lot of activities, not necessarily a lot at the same time, but that they are involved in social activities where they do have to have the opportunity to interact with other children. So things like perhaps being on a soccer team for a while, or perhaps if the child is interested in dance, to take dancing lessons. Even things like arranging play dates for your children so that they can have the opportunity to meet other children and get along with them and learn how to interact may be very helpful for children who are sort of mildly to perhaps moderately shy, but not necessarily so severe that they're refusing to go to school or refusing to take part in any activities. We do know there's some long-term studies of the outcome of shy children. And one thing we know is that the parents of children when they were very young, if the parents deliberately put their children in those situations, when those children became adults, they were not very shy. Now, they weren't the most outgoing person in the world, but they really had overcome to a large degree their initial shyness. On the other hand, parents who said, well, you know, it's okay, I don't want you to feel uncomfortable in social situations, which is what parents do. They want to take care of their children and not expose them to things that make them uncomfortable. But those children never outgrew their shyness and remained shy as adults.
I would guess that children who are shy and reticent would be helped by maybe small groups of kids, not putting them in groups of 10 or 15, putting them in groups of 2 or 3, trying to get somebody who maybe is a leader in the classroom who would then be that kid's friend, or somebody who maybe has an interest in stamp collecting just like this child, or something like that, that's more of an easing in.
I think that's a good way to start, but I think the point should not be lost that most of these children know that they're shy. So I think in talking to them about how they feel in these situations, we have never yet, or at least I have never yet, spoken to a child. And when we ask them questions about friendships, we say, do you think you have more friends than most kids, fewer friends, or about the same? And these children consistently will say, I have fewer friends than most kids. So I think that sometimes we shouldn't be afraid to talk about it, because I think in a large number of these children, they know that somehow they don't have the same number of friends and that they're more uncomfortable than other kids they know. So sometimes I think talking to them about it and telling them that, you know, there's something they can get over this, they can feel better, and there's things that they can do. Most of the kids are pretty excited. And I think some of the things you said, starting out with small groups, would really be most appropriate. The recommendation of professionals would then be to work up to some larger groups as well. So to continue along the path and not just stop at small interactions, but encourage the children to do whatever it is they would like to do.
Dr. Turner, what would you say is the biggest mistake parents make when they sense they have a shy child?
Well, I think the biggest mistake probably would be not doing anything about it, not discussing it with teachers, not discussing it with other people, and not following up to get information about the nature of this type of condition and how it affects children. So that probably would be the biggest mistake. I think another mistake would be for those children who are simply mildly inhibited, is for parents not to encourage their socialization. When children are inhibited to a significant degree, they miss out on tremendous number of developmental milestones, both socially and academically. And it can have a tremendous effect in a negative way on their lives. So it certainly would be a mistake, I think, not to encourage that type of development. And as she said, I mean, the studies are very clear. Those parents who tend to facilitate their child's social development by encouraging it and fostering it and putting it in a place. Those children grow up not as inhibited as the others. So I do think the biggest mistake is simply ignoring it and not seeking additional information and help when they need it.
We had one mother who came into us with her daughter, and the rest of the family didn't think this young girl needed treatment. She was 12, almost 13 years old when we saw her. And her mother said to us, "Sarah is the kind of girl that a year later, no one remembers she was even in their class." And Sarah said to us that the only way she knew and could recognize her classmates was by their shoes, because she couldn't look them in the eye. And she would just look at their shoes, and she associated their voices with their shoes, and that's how she knew the kids in her class. That's, of course, one of the most severe cases that we're talking about. But even so, I raise that point in this context because the rest of the family was saying, "Don't worry, she'll grow out of it. Don't worry, she'll grow out of it." And clearly, she was not going to grow out of it.
And we might mention that when we first saw this patient, Dr. Biden and I both saw this patient. She came in with, you know, hair all over her face and a big sloppy jacket with a hood on that she pulled down over her face. So,
and we were in Charleston, South Carolina at the time.
Yeah.
So, oh my God.
So it was fairly warm climate there. She didn't need any of that. But that was a way of concealing herself and not having to interact with other people. This was a very significant disorder at the time that we saw it. And this child was in considerable difficulty, including being depressed. But yet, as Dr. Biden mentions, certain members of the family were suggesting that this is something that she'll grow out of. Don't worry about it. She doesn't need any help. That clearly was not the case.
That's one of the saddest things I've ever heard.
And so our listeners are at the edge of their seats. What happened?
She's doing terrifically.
She's running for public office.
She actually did. She became a class officer.
Wonderful.
Yes. And she's looking forward to a career as an actress.
Oh, so, my gosh.
That's
really a surprise.
And she's done, with us, she's done several radio and television shows talking about the changes that have been made, including some that have aired nationally. So she's done real well.
Wonderful. What a success story.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion of shyness in children.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. Today we are talking with Dr. Samuel Turner and Dr. Deborah Beidle about shyness.
Well, back to some of the problems that the severity of this condition will cause. Maybe parents need to know this. What kinds of things can you tell us,
Dr. Beidle? I think school refusal is one that we want to talk about, because a number of children do refuse to go to school because of the severity of their fears. They're afraid they're going to do something silly in front of their peers, and their peers might laugh at them. They don't want to have to get up and give that presentation in front of the group that day. They don't want to perform. We had one 14-year-old boy who came into my office who was refusing to go to school. The school was saying he was truant, and he just didn't want to go. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, "Dr. Beidle, I'd love to go to school, but I can't stop throwing up long enough in the morning to get there." So the severity of his physical symptoms was such that he couldn't get to school, and he was terribly afraid that the other children would make fun of him. Children with severe shyness, for example, refuse to go to birthday parties. They don't want to be in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts. They don't like to be on the soccer team. So they're missing out on a lot of important developmental experiences because of the severity of their shyness. We have children who can't eat in public, for example, somewhat like the little girl you were talking about at the top of the show, feel that they can't go up to a group and introduce themselves, or feel that they're so nervous and they start to eat, they might get sick. Some of these little children can't even go to a fast food restaurant with their friends. And so, again, another important developmental experience.
Right. No chicken McNuggets.
I'm the only child in school that wouldn't eat French fries at a fast food restaurant. So which was one of the things we did in helping him with his treatment. But so I think there's lots of ways that children can be impaired.
Yeah, I think so. And they, by their own report as a group, children who have this condition in a significant way report being very, very lonely. They clearly have fewer friends. They are much more likely to have symptoms of depression, mood disturbance, and sometimes in a very significant way. As a group, they tend to, I think, perform academically a little bit less than other children, and sometimes test anxiety. Significant anxiety on testing can be an indication of a much more pervasive form of social anxiety. And might want to add that the missing out on these developmental milestones tend to really come to the forefront in the adolescent, the late adolescent years, which is the time at which we see the greatest number of onset of this condition. We see it much earlier, but the absolute greatest number is somewhere around 15 to 16 in that age range. But there are many more pressing social demands. The opposite sex becomes very important during this period, and they will have significant difficulties with the normal types of behavior, like dating behavior. You will see people at the adult age who will say that they chose to go or not to go to graduate school because of this condition, or they chose to go into one occupation or not to go in an occupation because of this condition. It exerts a significant influence on their social behavior, but also their occupational selection and advancement. I saw not too many months ago an executive here of a communications firm who had been promoted to a VP position and now had the task of having to interact with lots of authority figures in a way that he did not before, but also had to engage in public performances in a way that he had not before. And he was absolutely terrified by the likelihood of having to do this. And that was his reason for coming in for treatment.
What a smart guy, though.
Yeah,
to
I'm
come
just thinking
in.
The same thing. The first hurdle he overcame, go for help.
Yeah. Well, I just want to make the distinction between what we might consider normal shyness and conditions that are much more serious that have been called sociophobia and more recently social anxiety disorder. The question has been asked many times as to whether shyness is the same as those conditions because the behaviors overlap considerably. However, we are unable to say that shyness is the same thing as these conditions. I think a better way of thinking about it is just to say that these conditions are very similar to shyness. They have the same sorts of behavioral characteristics, but they are much more severe and much more emotionally troubling to the individual who has them. So, for example, a young woman who looked at shoes rather than faces clearly had sociophobia or social anxiety disorder. She was not just shy. Shy people oftentimes do become less shy. They grow out of it. But those children who are severe enough to warrant one of those diagnostic labels do indeed not grow out of that condition.
Could you tell us a little bit about the ongoing studies that you're working with and whether you're looking for subjects to participate?
Sure. We're always looking for children who are interested in participating in our programs, either because they are shy and would like to not be shy anymore, or as we call them, our not shy peers, the children that we have who are very anxious to come and participate and help shy children not be shy anymore.
For people who are listening to this who are in all different parts of the country, number one, everyone needs to know how to reach you. Number two, what would happen if someone called you from, say, Iowa? What would you suggest?
Well, I think we can be reached at 301-405-0222. 3-2.
I want to repeat that while people are scrambling for a pencil.
It's 301-405-0232. And obviously it would not be very feasible for people in Oregon to come here for treatment in most cases. So I think what we would do is we would refer those individuals to appropriate people in their area where they could be seen.
Thanks.
What resources would you suggest for parents and teachers?
If we're in the Maryland area, or the, I guess the greater D.C. area, they can certainly call the Maryland Center for Anxiety Disorders. Our telephone number is 301-405-0232. 301-405-0232. And we'd be happy to help with scheduling an evaluation or whatever it might be. There's also a website that's sponsored by the Anxiety Disorders Association of America, and it's www.adaa.org.
Can you say that again?
Sure.
So everybody with a pencil is writing it down quickly.
Sure. www.adaa.org. Anxiety Disorders Association of America. And on that website, they can get lots of information about shyness and social phobia, as well as other anxiety disorders. And also, they can link to an 800 number to call for referrals in their specific area.
Are there any books that you would particularly recommend for parents?
Yes, there's one that we have of our own. It's called Shy Children, Phobic Adults, and it's published by the American Psychological Association. That book would be available from the American Psychological Association just by going to APA.org on the web. The book is also available from Amazon.com.
This is a wonderful public service that you both have done today. Dr. Samuel Turner and Dr. Deborah Bottle, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Our gift for our first caller today is an autographed copy of our second book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That number again is 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and tell us what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning in from. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about us and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.